Welcome to the Central Christian Church Message Podcast. We are passionate about leading people to discover and fully own faith in Jesus. It is our desire that the following message inspires you to take your next steps in your own faith. Let's dive in.
You understand why he took that much time at the beginning explaining to you that our kidding is really kidding, and you're to understand that we love each other, or at least one of us loves the other. He owed that to you. He owed that to me, because in the first service, he was mean. And I'm just a gentle little guy. No, it is so good to be here, to be with you. You don't know this maybe, but right down here, there's a big, big digital clock that tells me how much time I have, tells him how much time he had for that little spiel. He went over by 2 minutes. And if I go over 1 second, he'll get up here and tell you that. So I have to get on with my message. I'm just so glad to be back home with you. The doors of this church opened in 1959, July 19th, 1959. And the Lord has blessed it through all of these ministries that he just told you about in a marvelous way. Our founding pastor was Joe Smith, and he was followed by Charles Cook, and I followed Charles Cook. Now, Charles Cook left when the church was 20 years old, so we came when it was 20. And it had grown substantially through all those early years. It kept on growing during the years I was here. It has grown miraculously, marvelously, considering in particular the leadership. But that's not in my notes. No, the Lord has just blessed in ministry after ministry after ministry. And it's been marvelous to see it. Well, Joy and I came out for our interview. We were pastoring in Indiana at the time. Came out for the interview. Got acquainted with the leadership of the church and the people in the church. And her comment was, "I have the feeling that if we come here, they will be better for us than we are for them." And that's exactly what we found to be true. While we were here, we didn't talk much about whether we would come or not, but on the plane ride back to Indiana, we knew. Now, the fact that when we got off the plane in Indiana, I had to chip the ice off from around the door of the car so I could get in. It had nothing to do with the decision at all. But though we did not talk about it while we were here in the plane, we both realized individually we felt called to come here. Now, you don't maybe fully understand how big a thing that was until I tell you. Joy and I are natives of Oregon. In Oregon, we had the ocean, and we had the green grass and the trees and the mountains. Move from there to Tennessee. Give up the ocean, but we still had the green grass and the trees and the mountains. Move from there to Indiana. Give up the mountains, but we still had the green grass and the trees. And then we moved to Arizona. And Joy decided she didn't want to move anywhere else. We're going the wrong direction. Just the year before that, we attended our national convention in Anaheim from Indiana, stopped in Yuma to get gas. It was close to midnight and close to 100 degrees. Joy stepped out of the car. She took a deep, burning breath and said, "Phew, and to think people live in this stuff." Well, people do live in this stuff, and they build good churches in this stuff, and we came to be with the people who live here and build great churches. I got to follow Charles Cook, and Charles Cook was simply a marvelous human being, so good that behind his back, some of the parishioners referred to him as St. Charles. And then they got me. And they were not at all bashful about telling me they noticed the difference. But he told me about the leaders of this church. He said, "Roy, be careful what you ask these people to do, because they're going to do it. And often during the years that we were here, I thought of Nehemiah in the Old Testament. Nehemiah, I don't know how it happened, but he ended up as the cupbearer to the king of Persia, top administrative role. The cupbearer made sure that the food that the king and the drink that the king was served were safe. A trusted official. But he wasn't Persian. He was from Judea, what we call Judea now. And he cared about his people back home, because the conquering Persians, of course, were calling all the shots, and Nehemiah's people were feeling discouraged, depressed, devalued. And in an act of courage, Nehemiah went to the king and petitioned for the privilege of going back to his homeland, to his people, and help restore not just the wall of the city that had been torn down, but the sense of pride and worth of his fellow countrymen. The petition was granted. And so the king let him go, gave him provisions for the trip, gave him safe passage through the territory, and he arrived in Jerusalem with a band that he had assembled to go with him to do the job. Wonderful story. He left the capital of Persia, went west to the promised land. That's kind of what we did, we felt, when we moved to Arizona. Because for us, it absolutely became the promised land. And in the years I was here, and certainly as I was thinking through what I wanted to tell you today, Nehemiah came to mind. Because there's some parallels. When he got to where he was going to do the job he had to do, that God had called him to do, he found there already a people of faith. And he had along with him people of faith, people who believed in God, people who believed in his leadership, people who wanted to get the job done. Now, they ran into criticism. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. But they also knew that God was with them. In fact, when Nehemiah had to defend himself against the critics, he didn't tell the critics what a wonderful guy he was. No, his answer was simply this: the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. And they did. And he trusted God, and his people trusted him, and together they went to work to build that wall. Well, what we found here is what Nehemiah found: people of faith who have been, in this case, a people of faith for 65 years. Actually, our understanding that we had fallen into the arms of a people of faith began before we ever got here. I received a phone call. I was ministering in Indianapolis, received a phone call from Dale Hudson, who was the chairman of the search committee for the new pastor. So he called me to tell me that they would like to have me consider coming to Mesa as the new pastor. Now, he must have heard the hesitancy in my voice. Where is this? Mesa. Mesa, Arizona. Mesa, Arizona in the desert? Mesa, Arizona. And he said, oh, no, I'm not asking for a decision now. I just want you to pray about it. Well, what are you going to say to a guy? No, I'm not going to pray about it. So I prayed about it. And we came to Mesa. My ministry began on April the 1st. Not one of my smartest decisions. A leader in the church in Indianapolis said, well, yeah, wait till they discover they got the fool. Well, in fact, my first sermon that day, I entitled it, What Kind of Fool Am I? Well, I was God's fool, and God led me and my family to be a part of this people of faith. And I needed it right away. I started on April Fool's Day, as I told you, but I'd come from a fiscally conservative church. The leaders in that church made sure that we never were out of balance in the operational budget. They pinched every penny. I arrived here in April. April is followed by May. May is characterized by 100 degrees. It comes a little sooner now, I understand. And as soon as it hit 100, the flock headed for the hills. And they took their wallets with them. So I watched the operational budget grow, the deficit grow higher and higher and higher. May, June, July, August, September, October, into November, we were still very much in the red. And I was nearly panicking. But what really caused my panic was that nobody else in the church panicked. Now, they knew something I didn't know. They knew December was coming. Now, I knew December was coming. But what I didn't know was December would wipe out that deficit. Because these people of faith were stewards of what God had given them. And all was well. And In January, I began to breathe again and decided these people know what they're doing here. Another faith lesson that they taught me. When we arrived in 1979, the church was then on Hobson in a brand new building, 2 years old. And as we were looking around, I said to Joy, you know, a good thing would be if we come here, I won't have to be in a building program ever again. 2 years later, we were in a building program. And in 1982, 3 years later, I was running around the country quite a bit in those days. I was president of our national convention, and I came back from one of the trips, and Judy Shark, my administrative assistant, said, Joy, the property search committee wants to meet with you. I went to the meeting. They had found the property, they said, a plot of 33 acres on Lindsay between Brown and University, and the asking price is $1.5 million. Now, you have to understand, in those days, a dollar was worth a dollar. I know the chairman saw the color drain from my face, and he said, oh, don't worry. He said, we're not going to pay that much. We're just going to pay a million. We're going to offer a million, and then we'll offer to pay half down with a down payment, so $500,000 there, and then we'll pay off the other $500,000 over 3 years. I turned to Judy. Judy, how much money do we have in the new property fund? And she said, $60. And we built a building on that new property. Faith. Later, as I told the story, I would confess to people, this church bought a bigger piece of ground than I would have bought, spent more than I would have spent, moved sooner than I would have moved, went further into debt than I would have gone, and built bigger than I would have built. Oh, me, of little faith. And I thought in those days of Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was the Prime Minister of England during World War II. When the war was over, he was commending the British people for what they had done to save their country during the war. And then when he finished commending them in his grandiloquent way, he said of himself as Prime Minister, and I was privileged to give the roar. That's exactly what I felt as the pastor of this church. Oh, how the people worked. Oh, how the people gave. And I just gave the roar. Now, back to Nehemiah. Another parallel is with criticism. Here's the first hint of what's to come. It's in the second chapter, and Nehemiah's hearing the critics. But here's how he answered. Let me give you the first, this is verse 10. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite, the official, heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Isn't this fascinating? It doesn't matter where you look in history, you'll find people who can't stand it that other people are getting something good in their life. True here. Here's chapter 4. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews. And in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring these stones back to life from the heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What they're building, even a fox climbing up on it would break down the wall of stones." Nehemiah responded with prayer and with renewed resolution. These were people in high places doing all they could to discourage and maybe even stop the rebuilding of the wall. They didn't want to see the people that they had insulted and sneered at and ridiculed restored to hope and dignity. And I didn't face anything like that here. I don't mean to imply that. But there were people who disapproved of our building program, of our growth. They were hoping that we would stay in that little building on Hobson. Some of them wanted that. Others wanted to, they said it was okay that we're building something new out on Lindsay, but let's keep the old one as well. And there were other criticisms. The one that, of course, that hurt the most was, Lawson, this is just his way to build his kingdom. So we dealt with those criticisms. And there were other challenges. In fact, we found a special challenge. Women. Well, now, they've always been a problem to me, but but some of the people in our church had come from more conservative churches, churches that didn't believe that women ought to be allowed into top leadership in the church. Well, I had a crisis on that front immediately, because 3 weeks after I started preaching, the young man that the leaders had invited from the East Coast to come and check out our church, because we were thinking of inviting him to become our new worship minister. Well, he came. It was a very long weekend. There was just no fit there at all. And so the guys were discouraged, and I said, "Would you like me to help?" "Oh, please," they said. So I did a national search for our new worship minister. And I found the new worship minister, and so I reported to the elders, "I have found him. He's a she. What do we do now?" So they deliberated, as elders are wont to do, and they finally concluded that it would be all right for us to go ahead and call her, but we'll have to change the title from worship minister to worship or music director. I pointed out, I thought it was kind of interesting that they would rather be directed than ministered unto, but they didn't see the humor in that at all. But that was kind of the start. And by the way, that story, you would think, didn't end very well, because that woman that we called to be our worship minister only lasted for 20 years with me, and then served for a while with Cal. And she contributed so wonderfully to the growth of this church. A woman in leadership. And that began, and it took a long time, it began a shift in the culture here to where we are now, with a genuine belief that God gifts both men and women and wants us both, male and female, to serve the church. Well, it's been good for me to read. It's been good for me to review all this and to remember the critics back then, because we're living in such a toxic time, in such a toxic culture in America right now, where, oh my, it's much easier to divide into camps, or it's often called to huddle in our bubble and carpet all those people out there, shoot at them, degrade them, insult them, yell at them, call them names, than it is to work for unity. And so I come to this. One of my favorite passages in the Bible is Ephesians 2, where where we learn how much God cares that we get along. Here it is. Verse 14, chapter 2, Ephesians. For he, that is Christ, for he himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by setting aside in his flesh the law with its commands and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace, and in one body to reconcile both of them to God through the cross. Unity doesn't come without sacrifice. Through the cross, by which he put to death their hostility, he came and preached peace to you who are far away and peace to those who were near. For through him, we both have access to the Father by one Spirit. Do you hear this? The Lord wants us to get along, to be at peace with one another, to stop fighting over things that, with eternity's value in view, are meaningless. They don't matter. And he cared enough that we get along, that he went to the cross, thus making peace possible, and thus teaching us the extent to which love must go for the sake of those loved. It's called sacrifice. Well, we found that. We also found a zeal for missions here. Don't need to say too much about this. Excuse me. This is what's called a dry sermon. I already knew about this church's love for missions because I had worked with Charles Cook on a mission board. Now, he and I have very different personalities. I've already alluded to that. But we are one in our love for missions, because he took as seriously as I took, as seriously as this church takes, the favorite scripture in the Bible. For God so loved the world, the whole world, that he gave his only Son, so that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And in case you missed the point in verse 16, he goes on in verse 17, John does, and says, for God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. So there didn't have to be any adjustment between Charles and me. We both believed, as this church believes, that God does love the whole world. We used to sing in Sunday school. I don't know whether it's sung anymore. The sermon seems to be getting drier. Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white. They're precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. He also loves the adults of the world. And so we came to a church that loves the world. In fact, the next observation I want to make is I'm going to shorten the sentence. We came to a church that loves. We found love. We had three children when we moved here, and we were pretty nervous about uprooting them from their familiar territory to go out to the desert. We didn't need to worry. As soon as they entered this church, fell into the loving arms of this church, they were at home, accepted by the church, accepted by their youth groups, where they made friends that are friends of theirs until this day. I retired from my last ministry a couple years ago in Oregon, and we moved to Missouri. Now, the reason we moved to Missouri is that when I went to college back in the mid-50s, I met a beautiful blonde, and I fell in love with her, and I married her, and overnight, she turned into a great-grandmother. And she wants to live with her kids and her grandkids and her great-grandkids, and I want to live with the great-grandmother. So we are in Missouri. She went out ahead of me to check it out. And on that little trip, that was in March, and we moved in the fall. Our granddaughter, Bree, told her daughter, Annie, age 5, that Grandma Joy was coming for a visit. And not missing a beat, little Annie asked, "Is she somebody who loves me?" Truth to tell. That's the first question people want answered, isn't it? You invite them to church. Oh, we have a wonderful church. We have a great preacher. We have beautiful buildings on all the campuses. We have the best music, the best programs. You can tell them all that. What they want to know is, when I get there, will I find somebody who loves me? They will. Here. Well, we found all this and so much more, but I've got to say one more thing that is not found in the scriptures. I've already talked to you. Nehemiah, he found the people of faith, and he encountered criticism, and that he had to deal with some things. Not the women issue. That wouldn't have been thought of at all in his day. I've mentioned the love of missions, a love expressed through the missions program. I've pointed your attention to the love in the congregation. But there's one thing that's not here in the passage, and that is, we found laughter. From day one, we were welcomed by people who did not take themselves too seriously. And I realize in my time with you here what that means. I've been criticized, others have, because of the laughter. But here's the deal. I learned that laughter is an expression of our worship. You do not laugh in the presence of people in whose presence you do not feel comfortable. You cannot be at ease and have genuine, serious laughter unless there's acceptance, mutuality, love, devotion. And you can feel at home. And when you feel at home, you can laugh. And so we had joined a group of people who feel at home with the Lord and with each other. Laughter can be a form of worship. Worship that incorporates laughter can be a form of praise. Now, it's possible you can go too far, as you saw illustrated early in this service. But we laughed a lot. Back in the day, you're still laughing. But I used to tell my proper friends back east that Central Christian Church has 3 holy days: Christmas and Easter and Western Sunday. And I know you've already seen how dignified I am, so you'll have difficulty believing, but one Sunday they even made me ride a horse through the sanctuary on Western Sunday. I was terribly embarrassed. I'm much too dignified for that. And on another occasion, they made me preach a sermon from the gondola of a hot air balloon so we could raise some money to build the building. Now, I was a professor who used to make fun of gimmicky preachers, and this church turned me into one. The worst thing that happened to me, though, was at the hands of Cal. That part won't surprise you, but he threw a big, big gala retirement party for the Lawsons. He was just so glad that I was leaving. And as a part of that occasion, they presented me with a Harley, which, of course, I had to ride out of the church. But that's not part of the story. What I want to tell you is I almost didn't get it. Now, he had put up on the platform a large thermometer with the increments being heights. And the lowest, as I recall, the lowest one was a scooter. It could have been skates. Anyway, I was high enough for that. And then a bicycle. And then maybe, I don't know what the others were. But the Hardy was way up there. Oh, he said, I'm so sorry, Roy. You don't qualify. But he said, I called the president of Harley Davidson. Now the man lies. You understand that. And he said that there is a way around the regulation. And then he brought out a box from the other side of the thermometer and said that the president of Harley Davidson told him that if I would stand on this little boy big bike booster box, I could qualify, and I stood on it, and the crowd applauded, and he handed me the key, and I rode the Harley out of the sanctuary. Only later, I nearly broke into a sweat, and I thought, Lawson, you got on a bike you had never ridden on, you rode on carpet, which you had never done before, and you rode through 2,000 people and didn't hit anybody. Okay, so we were laughing. And we laugh because we know something about the joy of the Lord. And though we were laughing, we were always conscious of something. And we even sang, but there was a song we used to sing in those days. We are standing on holy ground. And there are angels, messengers of God, all around. I saved the best for the last in Nehemiah's account. Verse 6. So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. And so Pastor Joe planted, Pastor Charles took over, and on through these ministries, the building has continued. Now, when I left after 20 years, we had only built the wall to half its height. And now Cal, well, he hasn't finished the job either. The wall is sturdier, it's bigger, it's stronger, but it isn't finished. And so a new pastor is going to come and take the reins in time. And he's going to, you don't really build a wall with reins. I'm sorry, that was a bad mixed metaphor. But he's going to come and be the next builder in charge. And the wall, the wall will continue to be built. Why? And here it is, right here. I can promise you, because I've had experience with you all, the wall will be built for the people worked with all their heart. So it was, so it is, so it will be.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Our hope is that you are left inspired and challenged to continue to grow in your faith. If you are looking for more from Central, follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. See you next time. Until then, go be the church.